Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Do we have a conversation for you? It is a real treat for me to welcome my guest today, the incomparable Roy Wood Jr., an Emmy nominated comedian, writer, producer, actor, radio personality, podcaster, known for his stand-up comedy for sure. Certainly his work as a correspondent on Comedy Central's The Daily Show. And most recently, you probably got a chance to watch him work at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner here in Washington, D.C., which is probably one of the hardest rooms in America to work. But he killed it. He did it. He knocked it out of the park. We're going to talk about that, the comedic styles that he has. And guess what? He may even tell us a joke he didn't tell at the Correspondents' Dinner. You want to join in for this one, folks. It's a good one. Right here on the Michael Steele Podcast. Next. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, look, I've been stalking this brother for the past for the past week or so, from the White House Correspondents' Dinner to the Webby Awards in New York City. It is a real special treat for me to welcome Roy Wood Jr. to the podcast, man. It's so cool to have you here.
Man, thank you, brother. And I apologize in advance. My voice is at about 70%. But I think we're going to make it. Because I'm not performing. This is just regular conversation.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, I've wrecked my voice enough to know what I can and can't do.
Well, you were good. You were good at the Webbies. You maintained. And when you got to a rough patch, you kind of slid through it, got a little help on stage. And so.
A little Milli Vanilli on the
little
song.
Milli Vanilli. Yeah, it was working. Yeah. It was working. So, you know, before I get into the craft of what you do, because I just find it so fascinating to watch you. I've been watching you since you got to Comedy Central, and I just loved the way you just sort of matter-of-factly bring out conversation and people just lock in and engage. How did this all kind of form for you? When did you realize you had that ability to tickle the funny bone in a way that you could stand up? Because this folks don't appreciate how hard it is to do what you do, to A, make people laugh, but then to do so alone on a stage in a darkened room every night.
The way I've always looked at it is that comedy is a conversation where the audience doesn't get a turn to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't like me, you're probably not going to remember me. Like in the early days of stand-up, what I noticed was when I would go to Atlanta, I was in school at Florida A&M, and I would travel up from Tallahassee to Atlanta to do Uptown Comedy Corner. And every Sunday night I would get booed. And then I would take the Greyhound back to Tallahassee. But when you're on stage and you're getting booed, you remember the faces. I can't explain it, but you just remember them. And every time I went back and I got a laugh, sometimes it would be from a person who I know booed me the week before.
Interesting.
So it just, oh, they forgot. Or they're giving me a new, like, new runway
right.
in which to succeed or fail upon. So for me, it became less and less about being embarrassed and more about, all right, if this doesn't go well, I will Men in Black memory stick this away.
Right.
Which is part of what makes the correspondence dinner such a difficult gig, is that however you do, it will be remembered. And it will be immortalized in history.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about some of your moments.
Oh, there's going to be think pieces and anger. And, you know, you're going to try to Larry Wilmore me and what I should and shouldn't have said. Or
right.
you're going to try to Hasan Minhaj me or Michelle Wolf me. Like, you're going to find a way to be mad about something. So that puts a little bit of more pressure. But for me, early on, when I first started realizing I was funny, was baseball. So I was a bench warmer in mm-hmm. high school. And at my high school, we heckled. Your job on the bench is to heckle the other team,
right.
crack on them, attack them. If I see the kind of car your mama dropped you off in before the game, I'm going in on your family car. It don't matter. And so
bringing it up.
That was the first taste, because if you could get the umpire to chuckle or the parents in the stands to chuckle, then you knew you had something.
Yeah. No, and look, dude, that's the part of stand up that is difficult. And I'll confess, I had my one shot at a charity gig to do stand up. And it was a contest. All these folks come through, and this was probably about 6 or 7 months after I got fired at the RNC. So you know it was still raw.
Oh, so you was mad.
Oh, baby, did I? Yeah. We had some fun with that, but I'm telling you, man, this place was packed. It was up in Baltimore, of all places. It was not like, you know, some nice little suburban community center type deal. And you just realize, man, you are alone. And
yeah.
this shit better be funny, because if it ain't, you're going home with a paper bag over your head. So how do you, when that person boos, do you think to yourself, I didn't tell the joke right, they didn't get the joke? Or is it a combination of things in that moment that, as you said, just sort of sticks in your head about not only just remembering the face, but remembering that aspect of that joke or that story that didn't land the way you wanted it to?
Sometimes boos are fair. I think that's the thing no performer wants to acknowledge.
Right.
Sometimes the joke wasn't good, man.
Right.
You tried it and it was all right. And they said no.
Nope.
So you have to be okay with that. But I think in the bigger scheme of things, most jokes, you have to judge them. They're all individually owned and operated.
Right.
So if you like this joke, cool, but you might not like the next one, but you might like the one after that.
Right.
So some people are booing just for political reasons. Some people are booing just because you said a no word. You know, so there's always going to be someone that has a problem with what you do. You just have to look at the people in mass who like what you do and then just focus on that. You know, I ran that correspondence dinner set exclusively at comedy clubs in New York City
mm-hmm.
to know where I call them when I'm building my act. I call them support beams. So I know where the support beams are. Right. I know where the hard laugh is.
Right.
I know where the hard universal laughs are. The political nuance between, you hope that hits, but it's not promised. But there's nothing anyone in this room can tell me to make me think that this joke isn't funny, because I heard regular people laughing at it for 3 weeks straight.
And therein lies the rub. So this is the thing about the Washington Correspondents' Dinner that I think in one respect is a disservice to the great comedians who've come through that dinner. in that the Washington crowd, to begin with, is in large measure, you're looking at a room full of overstuffed, high-priced, egotistical individuals who do not want to be made fun of. You know why? Because they were made fun of in high school. They were made fun of in college, right? And so here you come up there reminding them and flashing back to some hardened days for a lot of these folks. They take it so seriously. And I've been at enough of those dinners over the years to just watch them, just the joke, not, I mean, I'm laughing, the guy at the table across from me is laughing, but the other 3,000 people are sitting there kind of going like, well, that wasn't funny. And that's because in the moment it struck a nerve in a way that they didn't like.
Yeah.
And that's not what the event is about. So how do you kind of figure out to make a good roast to do that, right? You got to put a little, you got to marinate the meat every once in a while, right? You got to make sure you got your onions and your carrots. How do you put together a good roast when you know you've got an audience that's already kind of looking at you with one eye?
So for the way I put together my correspondence dinner set, the strategy, and this was talking with my head writer, Christiana Mbakwe Medina, what I felt like I was up against with that audience was that no one knows me as a stand-up. Mm-hmm. You only know me if you know me as a Daily Show correspondent.
Right.
That is not my comedy. That is a character, and it's fine, but it's not everything that I am comedically. So before I can be truly mean or do an edgy joke about something that I call it dynamite, before you start juggling dynamite,
right?
It's like, and this is it's a perfect analogy for me. I learned so much in stand-up from opening for magicians, and that magic is about trust. And you have to build trust, which is why a magician never opens with their biggest trick. They little stuff, chit chat, crowd work. Right. I'm going to bond.
Got a dove coming out of their hand, kind of deal.
Yeah, and it's a lot of misdirect as well. You don't even know the joke is coming because I don't want you to even be in a position to judge. That's the other issue with powerful people. Powerful people, as that room is littered with, all think that they are the be all end all because in their careers they are.
Right.
So the objective out the gate was to establish that I was funny. So we do the Biden document joke to start. Mm-hmm. First joke, before I say hello, attack the president.
Right, right.
I got to punch the biggest person in the room first to show everybody, hey, it's okay. We're going to be okay. Then you find common targets to bond the room together. So that was my approach. So I attack the president. I self-deprecate myself to show you I'm not afraid to laugh at myself. Those were the first two jokes. Then it became, all right, well, let's laugh at Fox and Dominion. That's a common target. Let's do George Santos. Mm-hmm. Let's do gun control. We all agree on gun control. We don't agree on how, but we all agree that kids should not be shot, right?
Right.
Okay. So those are unifiers. Then you get into Tucker, then you get into Don Lemon, and those are bipartisan unifiers in a way. You get what I'm saying?
Yep,
because
yep.
Everybody on both sides has weird opinions about both of those men.
Right.
They are not universally loved by their party. So those, to me, that entire run, those are unifiers. Then you get into Trump. Then you get into DeSantis, then you get into Biden, and then you get into what I consider to be the biggest stick of dynamite is Kamala, because that's the first joke told against a woman
right.
in the entire set.
Right.
You know, we had material early on about Marjorie Taylor Greene, and we had stuff about Dianne Feinstein, and it felt dicey to do. It's the type of target where if you don't nail it perfectly, you're just a man attacking a woman.
Right.
And that's all they're going to say about you tomorrow.
And that's not going to work no matter how you cut it. I mean, that just opens up a door that you just like, okay, I'm going to stand out here. I'm not going in there.
Yeah. And it's like, if they knew me, maybe like if I did the correspondence dinner next year or another time, I could probably take some more. I could juggle more dynamite.
You could.
Now you know me.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. Let's take you set up the set pretty nicely. And particularly when you talked about the staging, how you went through it. But even with the, where it seemed to, which was interesting, the response to the gun joke with the kids, let's take a quick little walk down memory lane on that bad boy.
Oh yeah, George couldn't be here tonight. He's auditioning for RuPaul's Drag Race. That's not bad. That's not bad. We say good luck to you, George. Sashay away. And also, speaking of drag queens, can we stop with the grooming stuff? Can you stop talking about that? Drag queens are not at a school to groom your kids.
Everybody agrees, right?
And even if they were, most of them kids gonna get shot at school. It ain't no problem. Don't problem.
I love that moment. You had them. They were like, yeah, you know, they you know, we agreed that the social commentary was politically correct. And then you were like, yeah, because they all gonna get shot anyway, so it don't matter. And they were like, well, you weren't supposed to say that.
Yo, yo, yo. That was the first groaner. And that joke, for the record, always got a groan. In the clubs, it never got a laugh. It always got a groan, and I like it.
Yeah,
I like the fact that if it's a problem, then change it.
Well, that was the point. That's the social commentary piece that I don't think people really appreciated in that moment. Was like, and because you said it, you made the sort of the Obama joke about, you know, it, don't boo, vote. Well, you say, well, yeah. Don't groan, do something about it, and you. I think that struck such a nerve because you did set them up in a way. You got them applauding the socially politically correct thing to say about drag queens and not grooming kids. And then you had to remind them, oh yeah, let's weigh the cause and effect here. Let's weigh the outcome of things and say, okay, drag queen versus getting killed in the schoolyard.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that, when you go past that moment and you look at it and you alluded to it, you say, well, it got a groan everywhere. I love the context and the reason for it. Do you still find that that's still could be a little bit dicey sometimes where you just kind of, you see that subject matter that, yeah, you know, when you test it, everyone's kind of their nose flare up and they get a little bit antsy, but you want to play it anyway. You want to move.
Well, let me just say that, you know, I read all my tweets. Not everybody liked that joke. Not in terms of you made fun of dead kids. And I'm like, right. No, I didn't. I predicted potentially future dead kids.
Right.
But I did not make, you know, so it's like that part of it.
Right.
Everyone is not going to like what you do, and you have to be okay with that. And it's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, well, and that kind of opens up the door. You know, I've been talking, you know, with a number of your colleagues over the last couple of years, especially at various events and seeing them around town on things. And this whole concept of cancel culture and the impact that it's having, that it has had on folks like you who do what you do, who provide the mirror for the audience, right? Here, I'm going to reflect back to you a little bit of how you show your ass every day, right? Mm. And how you sound and how you look, right?
Yeah.
And then the cancel culture piece kind of plays in, oh, you can't say that. You can't. Oh my God, I'm so offended. You know, they start the clutching of the pearls and the noise. And we've watched a number of comedians get hooked up on that. What's that tightrope like? Not just at an event like the Correspondents' Dinner, because you're going to be much more careful there, obviously. But when you're in the club and you just want to lay down your set in an honest way, how does that kind of change that approach?
It, for me, the only thing I've done differently in the clubs is that I'll put edgier stuff a little later in my act. You know, I have a bit that I've been working on now about gun control and, you know, essentially it's basically a parallel about how there's a lack of chit chat in the stores. The retail experience has become very impersonal in America.
Right.
With self-checkout and, you know, cashiers don't really talk to you anymore. And I feel like if we had that chit chat at the gun store, at least it would cut down on some of the shootings, because right. I've been in a gun store. The customer service is terrible. Like, just like you talk about easy to get a gun. Yeah. But also they're rude. Maybe if you were nice, maybe I wouldn't want to go shoot people.
Right.
And so it's more intricate than that. But in certain markets, the moment I say I go and shoot guns, liberals are, well, how could you?
Right.
You're not even listening to the joke anymore.
Right.
So that's a joke. I look at my hour as thirds. So the gun control joke is a second third or back third mm-hmm. joke. Because if I go into it too early, that I don't own a gun, but I go shoot guns. That is a true statement.
Mm-hmm.
But if I do that too early in my act, then I have to digress and explain why. Well, I had a child and I didn't want the child to find the gun, because kids are good at finding shit.
Right.
That's what they do.
That's what they do.
You know, and if I buy a gun, I'm gonna leave it out, because I want to be like, when you buy something nice, you want it out for everybody to see. And that's the joke. And you get
right,
so.
Right, right.
But because I've said a no word, which is gun is sometimes okay,
mm-hmm.
I've derailed my own comedy show because of the psyche of the audience. So,
well, you must have people running for couches when you start talking about white folks, because, dude, I just love it. So you did this great interview leading up to the Correspondents' Dinner, and I want to quote from it. You said, you know, the audience was too white to make, well, this was from the story, that audience was too white to make a Lori Harvey joke. And the black journalists in the room would appreciate a joke about the shade room, but there probably wouldn't be enough black journalists there for it to be worth it. And it's so true. I mean, it is so true. But then you, and I've, you know, watched and looked at some of your other stand-up in this space, you just take it head on and you kind of address the sort of racial divide. I mean, again, guns are a, you know, sensitive issue, you know, transgender and gay storylines are sensitive issues. But the race line to me is always the one where the really good comedians know how to tell that story in a way that makes people kind of pay attention and stand up. And like you just said, you know, you could lose a third of your audience if you come at the gun thing the wrong way, right?
Yep.
Do you find that when you start to say, hey, I see we got some white folks in the room tonight, and then you're off and running?
Yeah, I think really what happens now is, especially in cancel culture, is that audiences are more prone to tighten up during the setup. Pre-cancel culture, people would wait until the punchline to hate you. Ah. Now you don't get the luxury of getting to the punchline. It's an assumption, because you have said this word, my brain is going to, based on our own internal algorithm, I'm going to assume the next 8 points you're going to say about this thing. So if I go, oh, there's white people in here, you know, a great example of that, and I can't remember what interview that was from, what you just read from, but I know the question was about the Vanderpump Rules joke.
Mm-hmm.
And so Felonious Monk, who's one of our writers, one of my writers, not our, we have this Vanderpump Rules joke about the phone scandal and tying it to Tucker.
Right.
And this is just me being honest in a conversation with my writers. And Felonious Monk, he used to write for Larry Wilmore for the Nightly Show. So you know what kind of black he on. He on black, black.
He on black, black, yeah.
He on black, black.
Yep.
And I go, hey, man, I don't know what the hell Vanderpump Rules is. I ain't ever watched it. I heard a lot about it, but I've never watched it. And then he goes, well, it's kind of like BMF. And then our white writer, some of our white writers are like, well, what's BMF? BMF. And I go, well, that's like power. And they go, well, what's power? And I'm like, oh, this is the joke.
The joke, yeah.
And you oscillate between, and what's power? Well, power is like secession, but for black people. And I go, wait, I thought that was billions. And they go, no, that was, and that was a joke that was birthed from conversation of just acknowledging the chasm culturally between everybody in the room. And that was the most effective way to do it, because BMF and power, in my opinion, are a little bit more broad than Lori Harvey and the Shade Room in that space.
Right. Right.
So those were the right blackety black things to mention in that particular bit.
Yeah, it's an interesting development in how particularly black comedians, I think, have kind of leaned into, as these other narratives around CRT and the telling of black history by black people has come under attack. And whoever thought that that would be a thing, but it is. The sort of infusing it with the humor sort of lessens the hostility. And I'm going to take a quick break. And when I come back, I want to play a clip from your stand-up special, Father Figure in 2017, in which you talked about the Confederate flag. And again, given all the drama around that, the way you bring the conversation, bring it up in conversation, I think is really instructive on how comedians like you can just sort of get people to a point where they get the point. And not like you said, you know, get turned off on the setup or, you know, drop out by the punchline, but actually stay with you through the narrative. We're having great conversation with my man, Roy Wood Jr. And we're going to do a little bit more with Roy when we come back right after this.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. We got Roy Wood Jr. in the house, yep. Emmy-nominated comedian. He's correspondent and writer and producer, radio personality, The Daily Show. He's all those things. Roy, I wanted to play a clip about how you kind of lean into some conversations that can be a little bit prickly when you get into areas around race and talking with maybe an audience that's largely a bunch of white folks. Let's take a listen to how you kind of talk about the Confederate flag.
But if we get rid of the Confederate flag, how am I gonna know who the dangerous white people are? I'm just saying, the flag had a couple upsides, so let's just be real about it. I ain't saying keep it around, but I grew up in the South. I can't tell you how many times the Confederate flag came in handy
You stop him for gas at a strange place at 2 a.m. You see that flag hanging from the window. You know this is not the place to get gas. And you keep it moving. What's the rush to get rid of the flag? Especially if you white. If you white, you should want to keep the flag for a little while longer so at least black folks will know you cool. Because if you white and you're not an asshole, that's the one thing that helps us identify you. You get rid of that flag, we'll be, got to figure out a way to know who the cool white people. Cool white people, we just got to start giving y'all wristbands or hand stamps. Something you can show in a dark alley. Let us know you down with the struggle. That'd be cool. Give me your money, white dude. Like, whoa, I'm so sorry. Come on through.
what I loved about that was when you started off, you said, you know, if we get rid of the Confederate flag, and the audience was like, you know, and in that moment, just like, okay, so they're applauding getting rid of the Confederate flag, or are they really kind of getting where he's going to go with this?
Yeah, I just walked on stage for that joke. That was the first sentence out of my mouth on stage. Yeah, it was. I enjoy trying to also defend the indefensible. Now that I give the Daily Show credit for, my writing style prior to 2015, you know, I would talk about race a little bit, but I didn't go as hard as I did once I was on the Daily Show. And then the thing I enjoyed at the Daily Show, because the role of correspondent demands it, is that I had to figure out a way to find a different angle on a topic. You know, Confederate flag, like the same thing with my second hour special about the anthem. Stand for the anthem, kneel for the anthem, stand for the anthem, kneel. Well, what if it was just a different song? What song would we all agree to stand for?
Right.
And then that becomes an exercise of figuring out what musician is universally loved across all races and ages. And that answer is Bruno Mars. So it's essentially using the anthem as an entry point into how much everybody loves Bruno Mars.
Right.
And that's kind of where I like to kind of go, you know, a little bit with the stuff. But the Daily Show really played a big role in showing me how you can kind of rotate an issue and find a different prism to present to the audience.
How did your dad play a role in sort of shaping the comedian you are today? He was a radio journalist, covered black soldiers in Vietnam, South African apartheid. And certainly as a journalist in the heat of the civil rights movement covering that, he did a lot to sort of capture that moment, that period, and the moments within those various periods, whether it was apartheid or the civil rights struggle. How did that influence you in sort of taking these big cultural issues and make them part of a comedic narrative? Because they're sometimes very serious, weighty things. But you recognize, you know, if you like me, I like to laugh at some of that stuff. I like to, you know, to have that moment where I can see the humor in something very serious as well.
I think for me, you know, my father never spoke a lot about the wartime conflict that he covered, and rightfully so. I'm sure it was traumatic. But what I got from my father the most was a sense of pride and belonging in that black people have a place in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's at the front, so not in the back. And anything that I accompanied him on, you know, it was like, I remember one of my first memories of going to work with my dad was the 84 Democratic primary when Jesse Jackson came to Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And I was with my father backstage and he's interviewing Jesse Jackson for the radio, and so many powerful black people back there, and like just not realizing that osmosis is happening.
Right.
And just for perspective for the people, my father did radio news every morning from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. on the fives. And so when I would get, when I was out of school in the summer, you know, when my dad first moved to Birmingham, my parents lived in different cities because he moved to Birmingham first. And you know how it is with journalism. You don't uproot your family until you're sure you're in a solid situation.
Right.
So for that like first year and a half, my pops was coming back and forth on the weekends. But then in the summers, I would get sent to Birmingham to be with my dad. But my dad, not wanting to pay for childcare and not wanting to leave me at home alone, made me come with him to the radio station at 5 o'clock in the morning.
You're going to work.
Bro, I'm in the third grade. I got a shift. And so my job was to go out and check the wire machine while my father looked over stories. Because in those days, in the 80s, news came in on a printer that was connected to like OG internet. So to know what new news had broken, it was printed on the printer.
Yeah.
So my dad would go through the print sheets that I brought him, circle stories that were relevant to Black people, and then he would read those stories. So I just sat and listened to him take calls. I listened to him have commentary. And then when I got 15, you know, and this is about a year before my father passed. When I was 15, I had a learner's permit. And so the only way I could drive on the freeway, which was exciting, was to drive my father to a speaking engagement. So, you know, we go to Tupelo, Chattanooga, Knoxville, down to Biloxi, and he would just be speaking at a church. Every Sunday morning, we got up, we drove 3 hours somewhere, and I got to see him orate, and I got to see him speak with convictions about the things he believed and why he thought those things mattered to people. And it wasn't until my 30s that seed that he planted then started to sprout. But, you know, my dad was not funny. I ain't never seen him chuckle. he was not fun around the house.
Right. It was serious all the time. He was
very serious. When I was in the seventh grade, bro, I was in a dunking booth for my middle school soccer team. And my father came up to the dunking booth and yelled and berated me and made me get out the dunking booth because you can't have all these white folks out here laughing at you. You're worth more from your neck up than you'll ever be from your neck down. Get out that booth. You ain't nobody's clown.
I love it. Wow. And those are the types of things at the time you probably like, but dad, right? And it's not till later on that seed germinates and it creates the things that you're doing now in such a way that's part of that storyline that you're sharing with your audience. And that's what makes, I think, comedy so much fun to listen to, when you can really sort of pick up and feel that personal moment for the comedian when they're telling their stories. And it may be about something wholly unrelated to your childhood, but you get this sense that it comes from someplace that's good. Someplace there's a memory where that happened. And how does that inform what you do today, right now, particularly when you're doing the kind of comedy you do on Comedy Central? Do you get a chance to sort of bring some of that through? Or is it somewhat formulaic? I mean, how do you process the stand-up part where you can be Roy, right, a little bit more than when you're doing the daily routine of the Daily Show?
Well, I thought that it would be a little more cordoned off, but in actuality, out the gate, Trevor made it clear that I want you to be yourself. Mm-hmm. That is why you are here. And when you look at the correspondents that are all stand-up comedians, with the exception of Desi Leidick, we are all just heightened versions of what our stand-up personas are.
Ah, interesting.
We touch on different topics than we might during our stand-up, But, you know, Trevor gave me a lot of leeway out the gate. My first segment, the first segment I did, was about the first field piece, I should say, rather, was about police reform. And the Madison Police Department in Wisconsin was taking anti-bias training. Mm-hmm. And this was less than a year after an officer shot an unarmed Black man. So we were, that's a serious issue. It's dynamite. Mm-hmm. But I bet you there's jokes in whether or not this training is worth a damn. So we can remove the death element from it. And the thing I discovered is that at the Daily Show, you can effectively talk about the causation of the issue or the solution or the lack of a solution. So, you know, Trevor, they paired me with Jordan Klepper and we went and did that piece and it was great. The second piece I did was about the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March. I don't know who before me would have done it or could have done it, but for me to pitch that, and I was very nervous. Hey man, there's a see, you wasn't in America, but see, 20 years ago we had this thing called the Million Man March, man. It was really important. So they don't commemorate it. You think I could take a camera down there and you know? And Trevor was like, absolutely.
Yeah.
And we found the jokes and we found a way to honor something that meant so much and changed a lot of perceptions of people in this country.
So how do you do that, Roy? I mean, that's an interesting way you put that just now. You found the jokes, but you also found a way to honor the thing that you were joking about. That's gotta be a very fine line sometimes when you,
so,
cause you know how sensitive some people could be about their ish, right? And so.
What I've learned over time at the Daily Show is that when you are covering something sensitive, be quiet and let them talk. Let everyone else talk. And you're just there as a facilitator. So with the Million Man March, because we also have to make this funny and keep in mind, the Daily Show is still a show that's predominantly white viewership. Right. So ain't but so Black. You can. But to me, it wasn't a Black issue. It was an American issue. So the motto for the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March was justice or else.
Right.
Now you and I both know, or else is about standing up more, protesting more, taking more of a stand. I'm not going away. You are going to give us justice. You are going to give us police reform. You are going to address our grievances. That's what or else means.
Right.
To us. But I wonder what it means to anyone else who's not Black. And that became the game.
Right.
So we went to Georgetown and I asked white people what or else meant. And it was everything in the violence and riot and chaos and terror and Antifa. That was the assumption of what or else meant. And then I went and talked to Black people at the march and asked them the same question and let them carry the narrative. Mm-hmm. And then Brother Nuri Muhammad from the Nation of Islam, he was kind enough to come on camera. You know, the Nation is very hesitant.
Yeah.
With the organizations that they tend to come on camera with.
Yeah.
So for him to come on camera with me, that was huge. Like to this day, that's something I'm still thankful for, because we were able to break down exactly what the purpose of this was and who these people are. And so in a way, if white people in DC possess the belief that Black people are just going to burn the country down, and then I go talk to Black people who never mentioned that, and then I show that on television, mm-hmm. then hopefully you've changed the perceptions of other white people about what it is Black folks are talking about half the time. And you still honored what the Daily Show does, which is still sarcasm, you know, right. And being silly, you know.
But even more than showing white folks what, you know, trying to change their perception of Black people, maybe it's also trying to change their perception of themselves. Because if that's their go-to, that or else means something violent, is that projection? is that what is that? Why do you think?
Where did it come from?
Where did it come from? Right. Because I'm like, yeah. Particularly if you're sitting there, every black person you interview is talking about, well, we're going to continue to pursue our rights. We're going to uphold the Constitution. This is one of the things that drove me nuts about January 6th. You know, so many white folks in this town were dismissive of the comment that, well, if that were a bunch of black people doing that, they would have shot their ass. And there'd been more dead people that day than you could imagine. And they were like, well, why would you say that? Well, okay, history. That's why. History. But two, you lose sight of the fact that I said, if black people would do that in all the civil rights marches that we've been engaged in,
yo,
from the very beginning, it never occurred to us, or maybe even if it did, to actually go and storm the United States Capitol and start breaking out windows and crapping on desks and peeing on walls to score our political point. And so you guys offer an opportunity to sort of, again, hold that mirror up and say, this is you, boo. This is what you sound like.
Yeah. And it's been dope to be able, and you know, and the thing that's also cool about The Daily Show is that I'm not solely resting in race stories. We went and covered Army Corps of Engineer boondoggles. And like, right. I've done environmental stuff. We were talking about the green algae blooms in Florida. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say years before, I'm not going to act like we were breaking the story, but in terms of like, actually getting down there and trying to make this funny, I don't think any of the other news satire shows were doing that. We did a story once in Chicago where, you know, you want to talk about access and graciousness. You know, there's a group, Ceasefire Nonviolence, who go into black neighborhoods and mediate gang tensions. And these are a lot of ex-OGs that used to bang. And now they walk door to door and talk to crews. You know, in Chicago, gangs change from block to block. It's not a big communal thing like the West Coast. So the narrative around Chicago is always a talking point during elections.
Yep.
And when you talk about Democratic run cities that turn into the, and the black people don't even care about it. Okay. But what if I told you there was a group of black folks that go block to block and they have more trust than the police and they probably stop more retaliatory killings than anybody can actually count? And we have statistics to prove where their presence is in the city, crime goes down. Right. That's a real thing.
That's a real thing.
So I'm going to take a camera to that.
Right.
And I'm going to walk with them people. And that's
the important work that, you know, using, again, comedy as the angle. You can lift up and raise up the consciousness of people around issues that they hadn't thought about or looked at it in a particular way. And at the same time, draw out the humor, but also keep that level of seriousness in front of them to say, these are the things that are happening. You know, I'm going to show you this, I'm going to show you that, and then you can get to see both perspectives of it. Yeah, before I let you get out of here, I have a couple of things I want to talk to you. Well, two more things, both yummy pieces. The first is The Daily Show itself. There's been, since Trevor left and moved on to greater glory things to do, this sort of cycling through of hosts.
Boy, they got us out here like Jeopardy, don't they?
I swear. They're just
round robin.
Dude, it's like, okay. But, you know, my little two cents, man, I think you, more than a lot of the folks that are cycling through and will cycle through into the month of June, for me, it's like, who can capture that sort of Jon Stewart vibe, that sort of elevate the intellectual game at the same time, raising the social consciousness and having us laugh throughout. Noah did that. I think you, for me, this is for Michael Steele. I'm sure some other folks out there may think differently, but you kind of bring that spirit, that
yeah, thank
old
you.
School vibe of The Daily Show that I think a lot of people tuned in for? And how do you feel about being in the position now to be considered for this opportunity and hopefully, you know, be announced as the new host?
I mean, it's an honor to just have my name in a hat, I'll be honest. And like Jon Stewart coming on my episode and doing a pop in during my guest hosting week.
That was epic.
I truly did not know that was happening. I truly did not know that was being planned by Jon or whatever. So that was, oh, thank you, Obi-Wan. Right. But television is so fickle, man. Yeah. Like, you just don't know which way. And like, honestly, the writer strike has me very nervous about how late night is going to evolve. I think mm-hmm. that late night itself is in a state of transition into what I don't know. I know it's going to end up being something that has to be made cheaper.
Right.
So how do we still do the Daily Show under the new constraints that I believe are coming down the pipe? If I'm not, you know, the short answer is if they ask me to host the show, I gotta do that.
Yeah.
That's a calling. That's a deployment, bro. Like exactly. That's not even, there's nowhere else where that I can think of where African American would have access to Americans four nights a week.
No.
In late night.
Unless late night. Unless you're, or any night, unless your name is Obama.
The last African American I know who had access to Americans in late night, in prime time, five nights a week was Don Lemon.
Don Lemon, yeah.
You see what y'all did to Don? You know, ran him off,
and it weren't too subtle about it. Putting him on daytime television with two white women, it
didn't
be a problem.
Now, if you know, you want to know a joke that I didn't do at the Correspondents' Dinner. Hang on. I'm going to bless you with a joke that I did not do at the Correspondents' Dinner. And because I want to read it so it's accurate, because I don't want to just kind of glaze over it. Here we go. But Don's behavior was not his fault. Y'all set him up. You made him stop drinking on New Year's Eve.
That's so true.
Then you tried to set him up for a sex scandal like TJ Holmes. You put him on TV between two women and hope he would take the bait. But you forgot that Don Lemon was gay. Don is too smart for your sex scandal setup. He's not stupid like TJ. And with respect to TJ Holmes, one, I didn't want to call him stupid because he's in love. They're getting married. Yeah. Two, we were too far removed from the TJ and Amy scandal that joke to immediately.
The pop, right.
Yeah. The software that I need pre-installed in your brain for that joke to work would take a minute to load.
Right. Exactly.
So we couldn't do that one. But no, like, yo, like late night is changing.
It is.
And we got to figure out what is changing into. We got to figure out what news parody is going to continue to look like. But for as long as Comedy Central has a vehicle that is reaching Americans four nights a week, and if they even smidgenly, they accidentally ask me to host, I'm showing up.
Nah. And look, dude, you have an opportunity to take that genre to the next level. And that's what I love about, you know, the work that you do. You can evolve it around a lot of different subject matters, as you just already articulated. It's not just about, yes, I'm going to talk to you about race, or I'm going to talk to you about guns. I can talk to you about the environment. I can talk to you about, you know, why people like chicken feet. You know, there's a whole series of things that run from the sublime to the stupid to the silly that I think in these times, particularly given the way our politics and our culture are at odds and are driving various narratives, to have that sort of steady voice that kind of says, okay, y'all, take a time out. It's 11:30 at night or 10:30 at night, whatever time you're watching this, right? I need you to take a moment and laugh. I need you to take a moment and decompress.
And that's part of why I feel like even if I'm not picked as a host, I do hope that Comedy Central chooses a host and doesn't stay in a permanent rotation, because I think comedy works best when there is trust.
Yeah.
And once you have trust night after night after night, then comedically the type of risk you can juggle better dynamite.
Right.
When an audience trusts you.
That is so true.
And if you're changing week to week, okay, there's cool novelty aspects to that, but we're not Saturday Night Live. It's not the same.
It's not the same.
You know, Saturday Night Live, the cast is the star. The Daily Show, the host is the star. It doesn't even matter who the host is at SNL half the time, because you know the cast is going to bring it.
They're going to carry it. And that's not the situation, the Daily Show. And it's not the situation when you're on stage too, again, which coordinates, you are the reason folks are there. And even with an audience that's familiar with you, you're still building trust. You're still building that relationship with them in a way that, you know, I made you laugh the last time we're together. I'm going to make you laugh a little bit more this time. And you may laugh at some things you didn't think you otherwise would laugh at, because you trust me to go there. And that's hard work. You've gotten, before I let you go, definitely want to plug and encourage folks to look for your live stand-up tour that's starting up in June. Happy to be here. You're going to be across the country this summer. Sir. Tell us a little bit about that, and excited about it? Or how you feeling? Yeah.
Well, you know, this is my first time out since the shutdown. You know, I did a truncated tour in 2021. Mm-hmm. In an effort to shoot an hour special, my third special on Perfect Messenger, I shot in Denver during the shutdown. Like, they were just, like, we were at 60% venue capacities.
Right.
When I was on tour then. So, you know, I'm just happy to be back out and just talking trash on stage. So just go to my website and come see me live. I promise you.
Look, I plan you coming to DC?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Well, first weekend of August. I'll set up the tickets.
Oh, that we definitely will be there to cheer on Roy Wood Jr. I don't heckle. I just don't laugh. I just, like, you ain't funny. I'm just gonna sit there.
Black people. Classic.
And the classic. Just, he ain't funny.
You was aight.
Yeah. Can I have another drink? Put it on this tab. Since I'm not paying for this.
No.
Roy Wood Jr., you man, I appreciate you coming by. I love this conversation. I wanted to take it to a level where you could just kind of relax and talk about what you do without having to be funny.
I appreciate it. Seriously.
Everybody expects comedians to tell a joke. Every other word's got to be a joke.
Come on, be funny. I'm like, hey, I ain't got it in me today.
But you do have it in you. You make us laugh. You make us think. And man, I just appreciate seeing you every time I get a chance to. I love watching you do your thing. And looking forward to watching you do your live Happy to Be Here show this summer. Sir. Look forward, folks, across the country. You want to follow Roy on Twitter at Roy Wood Jr., J-R. And just appreciate your work out there, bro.
Hey, thank you very much, man. Appreciate it.
That does it for this conversation, folks. You know it's a blessing every time you tune in and share the moment with me and the guests. I really appreciate it. Check me out on Twitter at Michael Steele. You know where to find me on the podcast at podcast_Steele_podcast. And until next time, be safe. It's getting warmer out there. Well, actually, it's not. That's the other thing, Roy. Can you do something about the weather?
Weather's great.
Okay.
It's great.
It's just great. Cold. It's just cold now. That's all.
I like winter.
I'm a winter guy too, but when it's supposed to be spring and summer, can we do spring and summer instead of?
No, I want winter year round. It lowers crime. It's too cold to shoot. The bullets can't travel as far. I know science.
Okay, we're gonna go research that one. Later, folks.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.